The second case for oral argument this morning is David J. Iverson Appellant versus NPC International Appellee. And for the appellant, we have Mr. Stephen Binger, an attorney from Sioux Falls. And for the appellee, we have Mr. Douglas Diebert, an attorney also from Sioux Falls. Judge Justice Severson has disqualified himself in this case. And the court has appointed the Honorable Randall Macy, a circuit judge from the 4th Judicial Circuit, to sit in Justice Severson's place. Mr. Binger, you may proceed, sir, and you have 20 minutes.
Good morning. May it please the members of the court and counsel. The case before the court today raises issues that pertain to the liability of an employer for the criminal actions of its employee. This is the third time in the last few years that a case of this nature has come before this court. This is, however, the first time that a case of this nature involved the issue of employer liability for a violent, intentional tort perpetrated by an employee right on the premises of an establishment held open to the public. The facts are detailed in our briefs, but all of the events in this case took place on September 8, 2007. And the evidence that's been presented and which is on this record shows that Norman Williams was working for Pizza Hut on that particular evening. He had known the plaintiff from working together with him in the past. They had socialized sometimes. They'd played basketball together, and they'd hung out a little bit in the past. They knew each other. And on that particular evening, Mr. Williams called the plaintiff and a friend of his, asked them to come over and return a CD that he had lent to them. And so they went over to the Pizza Hut specifically in response to the request, to the phone call request made by Norman Williams. When they got there, the plaintiff's friend went in first and went up to the counter and asked for Mr. Williams. And the manager said, "Well, he's in the back. You can go on back and talk to him." So the plaintiff's friend went in the back and said, "Well, here's your CD back," and returned the CD to Mr. Williams. Mr. Williams took the CD, but then said, "Well, wait a minute. I want to talk to Dave Iverson. He owes me some money, so go out and get him and bring him back inside." So that is what happened. And they, in fact, when they came back inside, it was the plaintiff accompanied by his friend. These are two 19-year-old teenagers. They came into the Pizza Hut. They walked by the counter, past the manager, into the back where Mr. Williams wanted to talk to them. Once the evidence and the testimony of the witnesses shows that the manager on duty, only one manager was on duty that night. She was very distracted by a rush of customers. She was completely oblivious to what was happening, and she paid no attention to the fact that these two strangers had gone into the back of the Pizza Hut restaurant up at the request of one of their employees. At that point, at that moment, no one was supervising anything that Norman Williams was doing in the back of the Pizza Hut. He was able to get these two young men alone, and at no time did the manager go back there to do anything to check on what he was doing. And the evidence shows that Mr. Williams pushed Iverson up against the wall and told him, "Break bread," which, and I don't know this for a fact, but I think that's a gang term for basically saying, "Give me money." And when Iverson refused to do so, he was struck with an uppercut punch to the right side of his jaw, which broke his jaw, almost knocked him unconscious, and caused him to slump to the floor. At that point, Williams reached into Iverson's pocket, pulled out $100, essentially robbing him of that money. This was witnessed by his friend, who was standing there watching the whole thing. There were no Pizza Hut employees or managers anywhere nearby to monitor, supervise, or prevent any of this kind of thing from happening. He then tried to rob the friend, But and the friend was able to avoid the same fate by basically just pulling out his pockets and saying, I don't have anything. He showed him his wallet. He proved that he didn't have anything to steal, and that's why he was left alone. The evidence shows Mr. Williams was roughly 35 years old. He had been working for Pizza Hut for less than 6 months at the time all of this happened. When he was originally interviewed and when he first applied for this job, he admitted that he had one prior felony for mutual combat, which he described as resulting in serious injury, and he also told them that it was a gang-related offense. He also told them that he was on parole for that offense. And when the manager of Pizza Hut became aware of this information, his response was to do this. He didn't ask him any questions. He didn't ask him any follow-up questions. He didn't really ask him much about it at all. He did not speak to his parole officer to ask him what had happened in the past with this man, and he did not conduct any kind of background check. And it is likely that this manager, even if he had wanted to conduct a background check, would not have been allowed to do so by the rules and the policies of Pizza Hut. Even if he had thought it was a good idea to check this guy out a little bit further, Pizza Hut does not do background checks for anyone except its managers, regardless of the degree of contact they have with the public or the kind of work they do. If they had done a background check, as we've explained in our briefs, they would have found out that he was not telling them the truth when he talked about his prior felony record, because he had not just one felony conviction, but he had a second one as well. And this was for the offense of carjacking. He had spent several years in prison for that. He had spent time in prison for both of these offenses, and he had probably spent the majority of his adult life in prison for violent crimes. The manager on duty that night had, as the record shows, had very minimal experience at doing her job. She'd been there for less than 30 days. She had very little skill at supervising employees or monitoring the restaurant. That's what our testimony will show if we're allowed to present it to a jury. And when
you have several causes of action here, and you've brought several issues. What do you think is your strongest issue? You've opened with the first issue here. Do you feel that this is your strongest issue?
No, I don't. I think the strongest issues are the negligent issue, the issues that allege negligence. Specifically, issues in 3 and 4 would be the ones I would consider to be the strongest issues, the ones that should, in my view, definitely go to the jury. But the negligent hiring issue is also an issue of great interest, and I think is an issue of that should also be presented to the jury. The assault and battery issue, which I guess I'll touch upon now because that's issue number one. Basically, we do not rely on respondeat superior because we know from the cases that have already been decided by this court that Mr. Williams was not acting on the behest of Pizza Hut. He wasn't trying to help them or protect their interests. On the other hand, however, the cases, there's a dearth of case law on restatement section 219, but the precedents that we've cited in our briefs suggest that if the facts tend to show that an employee's employment allowed him to be able to commit the offense, if it made it possible, then the employer can be held vicariously liable.
Does that make the employer a guarantor?
I don't believe it does, because because what the cases say is if it's simply because the offense occurs on the premises of the employer, and simply because the offender is an employee, that alone does not make the employer liable. Only if there's additional evidence to show that he took advantage of his employment relationship in order to be able to commit the crime. Just like the manager who got a passkey and let himself into the room and raped the guest in the case that we cited in our brief. He took advantage of his employment in order to be able to commit the offense. And that's exactly what happened in this case as well. There was only one manager on duty. It was a very busy atmosphere. There was very lax supervision. He knew he could get these two young men alone in the back and nobody would do anything about it, especially because he knew that there was an inexperienced and inattentive manager on duty.
What was unique?
Pardon me?
What was unique about collecting this, quote, debt, unquote, in the Pizza Hut as opposed to in a car, in a parking lot, or anyplace else?
There's really nothing unique about it. But what the restatement says is if you are aided in committing the offense by virtue of the employment relationship, then the employer could be held vicariously liable.
But here, he could have said that Iverson refused to go in the Pizza Hut. What was to stop the employee from going out in the parking lot and doing the same thing?
Nothing. Nothing. But if he took advantage of his position inside the restaurant, then it becomes a factual issue that should be presented to a jury. The second issue, because of my limited time, I'll move to that now. The issue of negligent hiring is an issue that's been considered before by this court. In this case, Pizza Hut was alerted by Williams' job application that he was a convicted felon involving in a crime which involved violence and which involved gang activity. The case that has already been decided previously by this court basically, as I read it, seems to say if the employee has minimal contacts, there's no further investigation required other than an application and an interview. If the employee has frequent contact, then the duty of the employer expands beyond the application and the interview. So in this case, the issue is, did the employee have only minimal contact with the public? But the evidence that's been presented, which is on this record, shows that Mr. Williams had contact with the public every single day that he worked at the Pizza Hut. He had direct personal contact with customers. He handled their money. He handled their food.
But for the purpose of negligent hiring, we only look at the day he comes in to be hired. Isn't that right? We look at what they knew the day he was going to be hired. Isn't that right? So you're
yes.
throwing in facts that happened later on as he's worked there. Can we consider that in a negligent hiring case?
Well, but the fact of his prior criminal record was a fact on the day they hired him.
Yes, okay.
So
they knew he had. Can I ask this question? And you tell me if maybe this is irrelevant, but it kind of bothers me. You know, if we agree with you that it's negligent to hire this individual knowing that he had a prior violent felony, are we going to chill the hiring of ex-cons in South Dakota by recognizing that? Or is that even a legitimate question, a concern here? And
It's a very legitimate question, and it's a hard one because yes, we have an interest in allowing people that have been convicted the chance to get back on their feet. I acknowledge that, but at the same time, we have a responsibility as defined in the restatement to make sure that employees who have frequent contact with the public are not that in some situations that's when the employer has the duty to investigate further. Now, so in this case, am I saying that Pizza Hut should do background checks on every one of their minimum wage employees? I am not saying that. But in this case, and it would be a very hard question, though, when you consider how much contact they do have with the public. The cases that have been decided don't seem to say that it depends on how much you get paid. But it depends instead on how much contact you have with the public.
Is this relevant in the situation? He did not assault a member of the public, and the assault did not occur in a public area. So how much relevance is there to this cause of action based on these facts?
Well, I think it's still relevant that on the day they hired him, as to whether they made the right decision or whether they had a duty to conduct a further investigation. It's true that he didn't commit the crime in public, but he still committed it on the premises of the
Isn't this to protect members of the public, this rule?
It is.
Well, this victim's not a member of the public. He's a buddy of the defendant.
Well, but he's both. I guess that would be my response to that. He is, yes, he's a buddy, but he could be anybody. He could be just anybody that walked in, and the same thing in theory could have happened. So my answer to that would be he's both. He's a friend and a buddy, but he's also a member of the public, and he's considered that way from the standpoint of whether Pizza Hut has a duty to investigate their employees in advance of hiring them. Moving to the issues 3 and 4, as I've indicated in a previous question, which I believe are the issues of duty of the employer's duty to control and the employer's duty to supervise its employees. Even if we say that, well, he was just a minimum wage employee, maybe he didn't have that much contact with the public on a regular basis, and even if we say that they didn't have a duty to investigate his background, and if that's true, then at least Pizza Hut had a heightened duty to supervise and control this employee, considering what they knew about him. They knew he was a convicted felon. They knew he'd been involved in violent activity. They should have known, according to my second argument, that he actually was a two-time convicted felon. Knowing that, they had an increased duty to keep an eye on him. So if we say it's okay for them to hire him, it should create an increased duty on their part to keep an eye on what kind of activities he's doing. Under Section 315 of the restatement, it doesn't appear to be much question that there is a special relation between Pizza Hut and Williams by virtue of the fact that he was their employee. And again, Iverson, although he was a buddy of Williams, was still invited onto their premises just as much as anybody else would have been by walking in the door of the Pizza Hut.
You did not sue under a premise liability theory, though.
No.
Normally, invitee and all that stuff comes in then. So that really doesn't apply here, does it?
I don't think that whether we define him as invitee or as has been claimed in Pizza Hut's brief, a trespasser, or however we define him, does not affect their duty to control and supervise their employees, no matter who he is. Because, again, they have a duty because they have a special relation to that particular employee. And these activities took place on their premises. They knew they had the ability to control him. And they knew, or they should have known, of the need and the opportunity to do so. Therefore, those things meet the criteria in the restatement for establishing the employer's duty under these circumstances. And even their manager admitted at deposition that she knew it was her responsibility to keep an eye on these people. Within the confines, and again, considering that this act took place behind the counter of Pizza Hut, rather than out in the guest seating area, this is their workspace. This is the manager is there in person. She's in charge, and she's personally present. So no matter how we define this particular workspace, the duty to control and supervise your employees would seemingly be the greatest when it occurs in the confines of your own workspace.
We've always discuss the foreseeability. Would you address that? How does that fit in this case?
The actions, the prospect that an employee might commit a crime, might hurt somebody, might commit an offense, is foreseeable to any employer. The test of foreseeability, of course, is that we judge that based upon a totality of the circumstances. It is not dependent on evidence of previous trouble or prior injuries or mischief by the employee in the past. That the prior similar acts test was discarded years ago. Instead, we judge foreseeability based upon common experience. And it is within our common experience that an employee might commit an offense, especially if we already know that he's a convicted felon for an offense involving violence.
But in this particular case, though, hadn't he worked there for some time and without any incident?
He'd worked there for less than 6 months.
Okay.
And there had not been any previous incidents, according to their manager's testimony. However, that does not just mean, well, he's been here for 6 months now, therefore we don't have to supervise him or control him. How long he's been there with, you know, assuming he has a record of being a good employee and not causing trouble, still does not lessen the employer's duty to supervise their own people and to control their people on their own premises. Even if he had worked there for 20 years, it would not have changed the employer's duty to keep an eye on him. In the Small versus McKinnon Hospital case from the 1980s,
of course, that was a premise liability case.
It was, but it still focused on foreseeability as to whether it was foreseeable to the employer that a crime might occur.
And there had been other incidents in that case, hadn't there, that figured into the foreseeability analysis?
I don't honestly recall.
Well, there were, like, homeless people that had been there or some other things, and the employee leaving in the dark and things like that.
But in that case, the defendant repeatedly hammered home that we've had no problems before. This wasn't foreseeable to us. And that very argument was explicitly rejected by this court because the test of foreseeability in that case, the fact that a non-employee came along and committed a crime was considered foreseeable. In this case, the offense was committed by one of their own employees right on their own premises.
Thank you, Mr. Banger. Your time has expired. Mr. Diebert, you have 20 minutes, sir.
Thank you, Mr. Chief Justice, Justices, and Judge Macy. May it please this court. As always, it's a pleasure and honor to appear before you. Factually, if I can take just a minute to address a few things Mr. Binger focused on, and before I forget something else, Mr. Binger listed some number of facts that he claimed are significantly important here. I won't read all of these, but in our brief at pages 20 through 22, we list some number of items to which the plaintiff testified to, which are not controverted. Among them, Iverson agreed that Pizza Hut had no reason to believe the incident would have occurred. Pizza Hut had no reason to believe the incident was going to happen. Iverson did not believe Williams was going to assault him. Iverson testified he did not know of anything Pizza Hut could have done to prevent the assault. Iverson agreed Pizza Hut management had no reason to expect he would even be on the premises. So from his own testimony, some number of these foreseeability issues, I'd urge this court, have been decided. A couple of other small facts.
This is a question of law, not fact.
That's correct.
I mean, not his opinion.
That's correct.
He could have a different opinion.
I suppose so.
Would you address the foreseeability? That's the part that I'm having the most difficulty, I think, understanding exactly how you get the foreseeability as it applies to the duty.
I was prepared to argue a lot more from Curlin, but apparently that's not being relied on significantly by Mr. Iverson. Curlin, I think, addressed the foreseeability issue as directly and completely as about any case from this court on two levels, I would call that. The first is the broader level, and that comes from the California Rogers case, which essentially held that because of the nature of some employment, in that case contractors, the same thing as in Curlin, there is a heightened chance of friction between those groups. In fact, this court in Curlin discussing that, you use the term unhappily, and that appears at page 445 of Curlin, in describing that certain jobs apparently have the chance for more friction than others, contractors being one of them. So in the broad sense, Justice Meyer Henry, that, I think that's the first issue of foreseeability. The second, and despite some of these broad phrases from the restatement, foreseeability nonetheless doesn't rely on such things as they might have occurred, this might have occurred, and in fact, I think the strongest argument that Mr. Binger makes for the foreseeability argument uses the term might four times at pages 28 and 29 of his brief, and again once at page 31, that they should have known that something might occur. I'd urge that I don't know why they should have thought something might occur.
What about just allowing somebody walk in off the street and tell them, okay, go on back, he's back there. I mean, that's obviously raises some, I mean, that's some fact that causes some concern.
I'm not sure that is a fact. I know Mr. Binger quotes that when Johnson, the friend, first went in, Ms. Albrecht said, go ahead and go in back. I don't know, I don't recall that was anyone's testimony. But assuming it is, it wasn't a good idea. There's no question, though, that Iverson just blew on back there. And one other thing, I didn't devote a lot of this in the brief. It's been touched on by a couple of questions. I think this case can be decided on premises liability issues.
Except they did not. I know that you spent a lot of time on that, but that is not one of their causes of action, which is determined differently.
Well,
it's not a premises liability action.
Well, they're claiming negligence against an individual. So whether it's pleaded or mentioned as that, I would urge that the person has some capacity or category, and this court has consistently...
Well, let's just assume we are going to decide on premises.
All right, then I'll drop that. But getting back to these foreseeability issues, and specifically in the context of Curlin, one of the big issues in Curlin was the fact that Halverson, the assailant, believed he was protecting his employer's property. It had to do with the fact that mall management had employed the PKJ initials for three of the people.
That enters in the foreseeability analysis.
Exactly.
And they did have some knowledge that there was an altercation the day before.
Exactly. That's the point. Carrier, a nationwide player in heating, air conditioning, those kinds of things, had taken over the contract nationwide for the mall ownership. Well, when the PKJ people heard that, especially Kelly Cawthorn is his name, one of the owners, confronted Curlin the day before of this assault, called him some names. Curlin tried to shake hands. He slapped him away. In fact, it was escalating to where Curlin phoned mall management. A Mr. Kelly came up on the roof. They call it a penthouse, which is really a shack, where they kept product and things, and said, they're going to be here for a while working here. Stay away from these people. Therefore, PKJ, the owner, because Kelly Cawthorn was one of the owners, had knowledge of the prior altercation, had knowledge they were going to be up there, and had knowledge they were going to be using the shack because there were filters and things like that kept in there. All those things, Justice Meyer, Henry, and the other members of the court, weigh into the foreseeability issue.
So my understanding of what the plaintiff is arguing here is the foreseeability for duty purposes would involve the fact that they knew he was a felon, that the premises allowed him to be out of sight with these people, I'm assuming. I mean, that might be another. Oh, is there anything else that, I mean, is that enough, maybe?
Well,
That as an employer that you have a duty when you have employees that you think that you know have felonies, that you need to be, there's a heightened duty to make sure that you know what they're doing all the time.
There was a discussion between the trial court and counsel at pages 34 and 38 of the hearing transcript where back and forth and Judge Hoffman said, well, aren't you really arguing strict liability here? Because you say you should have watched him, this might have happened. And Justice Meyer, Henry, first of all, Williams was hired February 4th of 2007. The incident happened September 8th. It's a little over 7 months, not a big deal from the 6 months you heard. But during that time, he was an absolute model employee. You can get that from Teresita Albrecht's testimony. And in fact, on this whole foreseeability issue, again, I'd urge at pages 20 and 21 of our brief, where we list the laundry list of things that Iverson admitted. He didn't think he was a good guy. No one expected any violence from him. He was surprised. There was nothing Pizza Hut could have done. And I don't know what else there could be on the foreseeability issue, Justice Meyer, Henry, than those kinds of things. I think there truly had to have been something to alert management that something could go awry. Again, in 7 months, he's a model employee. Some felons work out, I guess. I think that's the
point. Let me ask you, why did Pizza Hut ask the question, do you have a felony record?
I can't answer that, Judge Macy. I suspect that's on all applications of any kind. That's the best answer I have.
No follow-up if the answer is yes, aggravated assault?
There wasn't, and admittedly, he admitted to one felony. Apparently didn't admit to another, whether that's disqualifying. And, of course, that argument presupposes that he should not have been hired. Those authorities require something more. If all it took was the fact that the employer has the right to assign duties, fire, and generally supervise, it would lead to strict liability, which we would urge simply doesn't apply here.
I think the biggest problem we have with this is just that it's it's a summary judgment in a matter of law. And what's the limit on the foreseeability? I mean, how much do you have to prove to get past the summary judgment on the foreseeability duty issue? And that's where I'm struggling. Where is the line? And you've talked about each of the different cases. You know, where is this enough? Is this not enough? I mean, how much do you have to show to get past that foreseeability for the duty to present it to a jury?
Sure. That's where I think Curlin is so important with the four things that happened. And again, Curlin, of course, involved summary judgment at the trial court level, which this court reversed. And it was based on those four things that had happened the day before, the altercation, I guess I can't think of all of them, but that the employer, that is Kelly Cawthorn, he's the K and PKJ, he had that knowledge. That was the specific, or those were the specific facts upon which this court, I think, properly ruled that there was a question of foreseeability, along with the fact that...
And he was actually doing company, I mean, he was angry because of the competition in the business as well, which is not the case. I mean, that was
exactly. And in fact, Curlin, what led to the assault on this, what I'll call the second day on June 16th, was Curlin was crawling out from under the penthouse, which was the shack with air conditioning filters, which he thought he was able to use because the mall had told him that. Halverson thought he was protecting his employer's property. That was one of the significant issues I think Justice Meyer Henry, this court addressed in those four facts. That he believed he was protecting his employer's property. Nothing of that sort exists here. So I think those, what I'll call the four items from Curlin, are so far poles apart from what exists here, and in fact based on Iverson's own testimony. So I'd urge that I think we're beyond the foreseeability issue here as a matter of law, and Judge Hoffman ruled correctly. I have no further comments. I would just urge that the trial court was correct in granting summary judgment, that there are no issues for a jury on any of these theories, and I'd urge that this court affirm Judge Hoffman's well-reasoned ruling. Thank you very much.
Thank you, counsel. Mr. Binger, you have 10 minutes.
Pizza Hut seems to hinge a lot of their argument regarding foreseeability on the fact that David Iverson, that night, when he went in, when he opened the door and walked inside the Pizza Hut restaurant, had no expectation that he was going to run into trouble from Norman Williams. He didn't think there was anything bad was going to happen to him. He did not expect problems from Williams, and he had not had problems from Williams in the past. So what we have then is the victim of this assault who did not foresee it and did not expect it. But as I stated in my brief, and I think it's worth stating again, if Iverson had had problems with Williams and really expected to get beaten up or expected to get seriously injured by this man, why would he ever go, who would ever go into such a situation where they expected trouble? And if they did, and let's say David Iverson had testified, yeah, this guy has beaten me up before. He's never been anything but trouble. He's always trying to steal from me. And, I still went back in the back room of the Pizza Hut to see him anyway. Then we would have Mr. Divert arguing that he voluntarily assumed the risk. I don't read any case that ever has said that foreseeability is judged from the standpoint of the victim or the injured party. And I think that's why Mr. Divert's argument is simply not an appropriate statement or application of the law. Because we judge foreseeability from the standpoint of, in this case, the employer, the party that bears the duty, not the person that might actually get injured. In this particular case, Mr. Divert also keeps emphasizing, understandably, that Mr. Williams was a model employee. We'd never had trouble with him. He'd been there 6 months, 7 months, whatever it might have been, and he had never caused anybody any trouble in the past. But I, again, fail to see any authority by reading any of this court's previous decisions that say that if an employee has been good for 6 or 7 months, if he is considered to be a model employee, then the employer has no duty to supervise or control that particular employee because he's always been good before. Therefore, that's the elimination of duty, which I've discussed in the briefs, which Pizza Hut would clamor for in this case. They accuse us of wanting strict liability. We accuse them of wanting no duty at all because that's exactly what would happen if their application of the law were accepted in this particular case. Why does the employer ask people questions about their past? It's because we want to know how they might behave in the future. And in this case, they knew that this person had been in a lot of trouble before and that he was still on parole. But even if they had not known that, even if they had hired an employee who was not a convicted felon and who had never been the cause of trouble ever before, would we then say that employer can just look the other way, don't have any duty to control, then there is no duty to control or supervise? I submit that's not what any of our cases say. The employer's duty to supervise and control is constant for all of their employees, no matter who they are, no matter what they've done in the past. That is something you're responsible to do every single day for every single employee. And it doesn't matter, from my reading of the cases, whether the employees caused trouble before or not. Because as was expressed in a previous decision, which isn't coming to my mind immediately, but anybody could cause an injury, whether you've done it before or not. That does not affect the element of risk or the duty of the employer to keep an eye on your people. Because especially as the restatement says, when these actions are taking place on your own premises. Now, Mr. Divert will use the Curlin case to his benefit a lot in this particular appeal for this reason. Because in Curlin, the injury occurred off-site, way up on top of a building where you're normally not expected to have to watch your people. They're not going to come in much contact with the public at all. And in that case, though, why was it foreseeable to that employee that Halverson might cause trouble? I think it was Halverson. Because there had been previous episodes and incidents the previous day. But does our law require that the employee have caused trouble in the past before we then have a duty to watch him or to supervise him or to control him? I submit our cases say exactly the opposite. Curlin established good precedents and discussed foreseeability, but the facts were so twisted in that case because the injury occurred off-site rather than on the premises of the master, in this case Pizza Hut. When it happens right within the confines of your own premises, you have a duty to monitor and supervise your employees regardless of their past. But in Curlin, things were different because that employer knew that this guy was looking for some trouble. They then had a duty to control it. If there had never been trouble by that employee on the rooftop of the Empire Mall, would the Curlin decision have been the same? I submit it might not have been. But our cases, and the case specifically says, the requirement of prior similar misconduct is not part of our law. Instead, we judge this from the totality of the circumstances, and we judge the prospect of an employee committing misconduct based on common experience, not based on prior episodes of trouble. And that's why the Curlin, the way that Mr. Dibert applies Curlin to this case is not appropriate in terms of how we judge foreseeability. In this case, as I've argued in the brief, Pizza Hut has a rule for their employees, and that is you will not engage in misconduct toward fellow employees or toward customers. Why would they have that rule if they didn't foresee the possibility that an employee might engage in misconduct? It's anything that, when we talk about foreseeability, we're always talking about mites. And I don't think Mr. Dibert's argument is very, very persuasive. We're always talking about judging future risk, things that might happen in the future. We are not saying, well, it happened before, then you have a duty. But if it didn't happen before, you don't have a duty? I don't believe a single one of our cases actually ever says that. And that's why we judge foreseeability based on the totality of the circumstances, not based upon whether it can be foreseen that the exact nature of the harm or the exact manner in which it might occur or the extent of it. There needs be no prior episode or no ability to foresee that. It's just the class of harm that could occur that would make it foreseeable to Pizza Hut. And Pizza Hut has already foreseen this. They know that their employees could engage in misconduct, and that's why they have a rule against it. It's foreseeability, I agree, and how we assess that and apply it to this case is probably the most critical issue here. But simply because he's been a model employee, Pizza Hut then asks that all of their duty to control and supervise their people is then gone for that reason alone. And yet that is not a correct statement of our law. It's a jury question as to whether what they did was negligent under the circumstances of what happened that night, especially in view of the unusual setting when this guy brings two 19-year-olds all the way into the back of the Pizza Hut where they have no business being. And the manager even waves them on. That is in this record. It is a part of our statement of material facts, and it was testified to.
The first one on, not your client.
That's correct.
Right?
That is correct. When Mr. Johnson first came back and said, I want to see Williams, she said, go on back. Then he went out, and then the two of them came right back in and walked right past her. So at that point, should that have alerted a reasonable person that something unusual was going on? Does any business just let people come and go in the back room and wander around anywhere you want? Of course not. This was unusual, and it should have alerted her that something was going on. And when she failed to go and check on him and supervise him, she could have prevented this. This was an avoidable assault. It could have been prevented if she had simply done what she had herself admitted was her duty.
How could she have prevented it? She's going to step in between these two people?
She's going to go back and she is the boss.
Okay.
I admit that she would not be physically capable of stopping this guy, especially if there was more information in the record about him. But that's where the cases say that the employer's ability to control comes from the employer's authority. She can go back there and say, what are you doing? Get out of here. Could she physically have gotten in between him and grabbed him and thrown him down and stopped all of this? No. But that's not what the law says is relevant to the determination of the employer's ability to control and the necessity and the opportunity.
Okay.
That's her authority.
I gave you an extra minute, but I think you're done. Thank you.
Thank you.
We'll be in recess for 10 minutes.